Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
When I was little, my father was famous. Dr. Stanley Quinn was a man of letters, a man of words, a man who'd built himself from clattering keys and spooling ribbon and a firm yank on his own bootstraps to become the greatest poet, journalist, and war correspondent of his generation. In real terms, this meant I grew up without my father around. Although as I remember it, he always seemed strangely present. Throughout his many absences, my father endured as an active part of my life. His picture in the press, his thoughts in the broadsheet black ink that rubbed off on my fingers, his disembodied voice from inside our kitchen radio.
That's Stephen Hall reading the opening of his latest novel, Maxwell's Demon. It's the follow-up to his award-winning debut novel, The Raw Shark Texts, which came out in 2007. That book earned comparisons to Philip K. Dick and Haruki Murakami, as well as Jaws and The Matrix. Stephen continues to explore more uncharted territory in Maxwell's Demon. It has a similar vibe to Christopher Nolan's film, Inception. Stephen's wizardry with words and his obsession with big ideas, like entropy, will probably have you questioning reality. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. We sat down with Stephen so he could share more about this mind-bending novel.
It's about a failed novelist whose father was very successful and his kind of feelings of being replaced in his father's affections by his father's assistant, who is also a successful novelist. And when we meet the protagonist, he's kind of languishing at home on his own, and he gets a series of strange messages. The first one that seems to be an answer phone message from his father, despite his father having died 7 years before.
Yeah, and then there's a message from his father's protege, Andrew Black, who is kind of a rival for his father's affections. Can you talk a bit about the message that Andrew Black sends to Thomas Quinn?
Thomas receives a letter from Andrew, and nobody's heard from Andrew in 6 years at this point. He wrote an extremely successful, multi-million selling whodunit and then disappeared. And as you say, Andrew has this complex relationship with Thomas, and Thomas hasn't heard from him. And then he gets a letter in the post, and inside it is a Polaroid picture of what looks like a black sphere, about as big as an orange, but that's utterly and completely black in quite a disturbing way. And a note that says, Thomas, do you know what this is?
Mm-hmm. And then things escalate from there. Where does the title of your book, Maxwell's Demon, where does that come from?
It's from a thought experiment in physics to do with entropy and thermodynamics. You know, the idea that entropy can only be decreased by applying energy, and that as a result, in some mysterious connection between entropy and time, we don't quite understand, time can only flow forwards because things are tidier in the past and messier in the future. And Maxwell's Demon is a very simple little thought experiment that shows that under the right circumstances, if a creature in the right place knows what it's doing, it seems to be possible to reverse entropy and therefore to reverse time.
Mm-hmm. And is it possible to talk about how that thought experiment, which it serves as the title of your novel, how Maxwell's Demon relates to your novel without giving anything away?
Yeah, I mean, it relates in lots of different ways. It relates kind of in terms of the themes of the novel, in terms of putting things right that have come apart, or finding a way to move back to a state of being that was before some kind of decay or entropy. In the plot, it also seems at several points that maybe Thomas has lost a day and arrived somewhere the day before he left, although we don't know whether that's really true or whether someone is messing with him.
Mm-hmm. Why did you want to explore such weighty subjects as entropy, physics, theology, and technology in your book?
That's a good question. I mean, I thought maybe I'll try and write a more straightforward one after Rorschach texts, but I couldn't. I think partly Rorschach texts does a lot of different things at the same time, and I felt compelled to try and do a lot of different things at the same time again, but in a different way, and also to follow some of the ideas that I'd started to become interested in and to really push through some of the stuff that I'd start to look at in Rorschach. I guess Maxwell's Demon is kind of the second half of those explorations in some way. I'm sort of plagued by complexity. I can't help it. I become really interested in strange and esoteric things and complex things, and strange ways of looking at the world, and I find that I can't help but kind of dig into them and kind of build things out of them. It's just my nature.
How much of the storyline did you know before you started writing it? In other words, how much of it did you have mapped out before you started writing? My sense is you wouldn't have that much mapped out. You kind of had to figure it out as you went along, but I don't know.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. Not very much at all. And in fact, the book that became Maxwell's Demon was one quarter of a bigger book that I was writing. You know, Maxwell's Demon is very concerned with entropy and autumn, but there were also sections on spring, summer, and winter. And the whole thing became quite insanely gigantic. And I kind of plucked Maxwell's, the autumn book, as I was calling it at the time, out of that and focused on that a little bit. And sort of found my way into that. But it changed a lot. It changed from the first draft to the second to the third. I mean, the ending, some of the reveals at the ending actually came quite late, like maybe halfway mm-hmm. through writing the book. I sort of changed my mind on certain things.
You say that your novel is concerned with tricks that stories tell. And one of these tricks you identify is that, quote, the writer is setting the pace for the reader to travel at, but the writer does not travel at that pace. Unquote. It seems so obvious once you point it out, but in all my years of reading, it's never occurred to me, and I found it a very fascinating concept. Can you tell us a bit about this?
I think that's the kind of thing that I'm drawn to, things that seem from a certain point of view, like, of course, you know that, of course, you've always known it, but if you stop and actually look at it and imagine what that means from the point of view we look in the book and from a practical point of view, it becomes something seems very counterintuitive. In the book, what I'm talking about is that a book is written for the speed that the reader reads. So you're constantly working through and you're reading what you've written back at the speed the reader would read it. In the book, Thomas talks about a path that's, you know, just the right. It's not got stones in that's going to trip you up on words or oddly built sentences, that you can move at what feels like the perfectly normal pace that, of course, you and the writer are both moving at. But actually, the writer's taking 10 times the time that you're taking to read that paragraph to mm-hmm. write it, or maybe much more. And so there's this strange thing, again, it comes back to time and entropy, that when you're going through a book with a writer, you have this weird idea that the writer's actually aging 10 times faster than you as you're moving through the text.
Exactly, yeah. It's a really neat lens to look through to explore the concept of time travel, which you do throughout the book. Does this have anything to do with why you include so many interesting typographical elements that resemble concrete poetry in your novel, which you also did in Raw Shark Text, but many of these in Maxwell's Demon are in the shape of leaves, I would say the majority of them, and that probably has to do with the fact that of this being Maxwell's Demon originally being part of a larger book called Autumn. Can you talk a bit about the use of typographical elements in your work?
Yeah, of course. I mean, part of the reason they're there is because I really, in Rorschach, and again here, something I find really interesting is that contrast between what we imagine as we read versus what we're seeing. You know, it's really easy to kind of picture the story of reading. I'm quite a visual reader, so I find myself setting a scene and a stage and putting characters in it, and it's almost like while I'm looking at the page and reading, I'm kind of seeing this film in my mind. And I know some people aren't that sort of reader, but I think a lot of people are. And I think it's quite interesting when you have visual elements on the page, it kind of counterpoints that, because what it does is it reminds you that you're not seeing those things. You're imagining those things. And so you're comparing and kind of contrasting the things you're seeing and the page itself versus what you're creating yourself inside your own head.
Yeah, it was an interesting experience for me because originally I had a PDF version of your novel. And so when I come to those parts, I'm reading it on my laptop and I'm, you know, turning it in the laptop in all directions. So the laptop got quite a workout. Yeah, definitely. So it's probably lost 2 or 3 pounds and it's, I don't know, 5 pounds to begin with. In your novel, Andrew Black tells the protagonist, Thomas Quinn, that the novel is an engine. What exactly does Black mean by this? And do you agree with Black's idea that the novel is an engine?
Well, in the book, Black has one very specific idea in mind for what this engine could drive and what it could achieve. But I think I was really interested in going to kind of religious and very old spiritual texts, that I was sort of interested in this idea of words creating the world. And I'd read somewhere and found it fascinating that, you know, in the Old Testament, when God says, let there be light. It's not until he actually says the word light and gives it a name that light can exist. And, you know, this very old idea of calling things into existence by naming them and commanding them with words. One of the things I wanted to do with this book was sort of build a mythology where I could play with that. And the more I went into these old religious texts, the more I found that it was already there. If you just knew what you were looking for, there were so many examples of it. And this idea that, you know, through reading and imagining is an act of creation, you know, and in these texts, not only in the mind, but kind of literally.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the examples that you found as you went exploring these texts. Can you give us an example of one of these examples?
One that I really love is from the Midrash texts, where the Yod is removed from Sarah's name by God. And so she becomes Sarah, her name changes slightly, and this little letter is furious, and it flies up in the face of God and demands to know what it was done wrong. Just because it's the smallest letter, how dare God remove it from this virtuous woman's name? Which is just fascinating that in the text a letter gets to have an opinion. And the way that the letter behaves is very much like other creatures behave in those texts, which is where the book gets to.
Yeah, absolutely. In the acknowledgments, you say that you are indebted to two books, The Hero with a Thousand Faces by Joseph Campbell and The Writer's Journey by Christopher Vogler, and they are referenced in your novel. How did these two books help you to create Maxwell's Demon?
As you could probably tell by reading Maxwell's Demon, I'm fascinated by mechanics. Mm-hmm. My father's a mechanic, and I guess I've only just realized that I've sort of become a mechanic myself without realizing it. I'm fascinated by the way that stories work. Those two books, both very, very interesting on the way that mythic texts work and the way that our brains are designed to receive certain texts and how you see certain patterns repeating again and again. And I don't necessarily write wholly with those principles in mind or even majorly with those principles in mind, but it's very interesting to see that once you see how those books describe a story always has this sort of character who does this, and there's a character who usually show up whose job will be this. It's really eye-opening, like, oh, yeah, of course, and their job in the story is to do this, but also as an audience, as a reader, it's their job to let us know the stakes of this, you know, all this sort of thing. And that mechanical element is super fascinating to me, and I wanted to write a whodunit which lent into the mechanics of its own story, so I got very into those books.
Mm-hmm. The central question of the legendary sci-fi author Philip K. Dick's work is, what is reality? And this seems to me to be a central question in Maxwell's Demon. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think so. What is reality? And also both of my books and a lot of things that I write are interested in the idea of what is reality, what is life, and is it possible to cheat it? How solid are those rules?
Yeah, I think you're right. Absolutely. You have an epigraph from Stephen King's novel 11/22/63, and I wonder if you'd mind reading it to us and then explaining why you chose it?
Sure. The world is barely there at all. Don't we all secretly know this? It's a perfectly balanced mechanism of shouts and echoes, pretending to be wheels and cogs, a dream clock chiming between a mystery glass we call life. How beautiful is that?
That's beautiful, and you have beautiful reading too, yeah. Well, can you tell us why you chose it for this novel?
It encapsulates in the most beautiful writing what I was trying to get at in this book. I think maybe there's a sense as you get a little older in life, you have an age of great certainty, and then as you get older, you sort of start to suspect that the world is quite an odd place and odd things happen. You go through your life, and it's a life of weird coincidences and strange things. And I think you gradually start to suspect that, as Mr. King says, that the world is not as solid and real as it seems in some strange way that's hard to grasp, because of course it is. Of course it's real. Of course all science is real. I mean, I'm not saying that for a minute, but you almost develop a very strange double think that suggests there's some angle you're not quite seeing, or at least I have as I've got older.
Yeah, very well said. Stephen King includes your previous novel, The Raw Shark Texts, in the reading list of his book On Writing, which makes me wonder if or when you write a book about writing, what do you think the most important advice you give will be?
Man, there are so many things to say. I think the really important thing to do is always try and put yourself in the shoes of the reader to learn the skill of going back through the text and reading it as though you don't know it and allowing yourself to trip up and allowing yourself to kind of be confused and sort of separate what you know from what's on the page, which mm-hmm. is a skill that's, you know, it's a technical skill, but it's so important. You have to kind of get out of your own head and allow yourself to be a little disappointed with what you've tried to do when you haven't succeeded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you very much for talking to us today, Stephen Hall. It was such a pleasure.
Yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure. Great to talk to you.
Stephen Hall is the author of the novel Maxwell's Demon. Find out more, or as much as we could figure out, at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Trevor Moore, Brian Broom, and Stephen Hall. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, Beta is now available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And you can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
And I see that Steven is back again this year. Hello, Steven.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Is that okay if I talk to Adam about this, or am I really, do we not want to do this anymore with this bit?
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
Please stop screaming at Doug.